Moving right into our bloggers roundtable, here's what we're tracking. A 15-year-old boy gets 60 years in jail for a crime he committed at age 13. There's a counter-protest against Al Sharpton's March for Justice, but how significant is it? Plus, can the death penalty deter crime? With us, media consultant Carmen Dixon Rosenzweig. She writes the blog All About Race, and also Shay Riley of the blog Booker Rising, and Mark Anthony Neal. He's a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University. He also writes Vibe Magazine's blog Critical Noir. Welcome, everybody.
Thank Hello. You.
How are you doing, Farai?
I'm doing great. So let's talk about the case of Sherman Burnett. He is 15 years old. Last week, he was convicted of abducting, sexually assaulting, and beating a 6-year-old girl. The crime took place 2 years ago in St. Louis, Missouri. Burnett was sentenced to 60 years in jail. Now, the judge in the case apparently received a letter from the victim. She's now 8 years old, requesting the lengthy sentence. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported that the young victim, quote, suffered a skull fracture, a lacerated liver, heavy bruises, and half an ear had been torn off. The newspaper report goes on to say that she, quote, told police she couldn't walk, so she crawled through a hole in a fence near the tracks but could go no further. As night descended, she said she tried to cover herself with leaves. From her hospital bed, the girl identified Burnett from a school picture. Now, Carmen, let me start with you. There are several blogs, including one called Skeptical Brother, that have been picking up on the story. You've been reading those blogs. What do they say about this case and this sentence?
Well, the blogs that I'm reading seem to have a problem with the 60-year sentence. The idea that you can determine how someone's going to be for the rest of their life at age 13, they find offensive and just wrong.
What about the whole the heinous nature of this crime, though?
Well, it's two different questions. The blogs that I'm reading seem to have a problem with the sentence. But if you read the threads of the blogs, there are people absolutely outraged, frankly, that this young man even exists. They are outraged that the death penalty isn't an option for a crime this heinous.
Well, you know, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch asked its readers to weigh in on the case and the sentence, and they printed some of the comments. Many of them asked or hoped that Bennett would be killed or executed. One of them said, really, there is no point in keeping this animal alive. By the time it's 60, what difference does it make if it's rehabilitated? It should be killed, plain and simple. What does that kind of rhetoric do, Mark?
I think it puts it in some sort of context in how we think about criminality in certain contexts, particularly when it's connected to race. You know, the thing that I would want to see in response to this is some sort of balance. Clearly, this is a young man who needs to be punished for whatever crime, you know, for the crimes that he's been accused and obviously been convicted of. But, you know, to indict him in this case, you know, and not indict a larger society, I mean, this is a learned behavior that I would argue is not natural for a 13-year-old. And he's clearly getting, you know, points in terms of how to act and how to interact with folks from a larger society. And I think it's very easy for us to say, let's just send him away for 60 years or let's just kill him, et cetera, you know, via the death penalty, and still not have to deal with the very complicated issues of why a 13-year-old boy would think it would be perfectly natural to treat a young girl that way.
Shay, where should the debate go from here? Because there's constantly debates over rehabilitation versus long sentences, sentences that punish versus sentences that reflect the age of the criminal. What role can the blogosphere, for example, play in this debate?
Well, you know, the role that the blogosphere can play in this debate is to focus on the crime victim. I'm not really concerned about Burnett. I'm far more concerned about an 8-year-old crime victim, a black girl, we should point out, who got justice. That should be where the focus is. And I think too many black liberal bloggers are rallying around yet again folks of highly questionable character instead of showing compassion for the crime victim. So I completely disagree that both of the individuals are, you know, victims of the system. The only victim here is the 8-year-old black girl. And I think that the key question should be, why was Burnett so out of control in the first place that he committed this brutal crime? And whether it was learned behavior or, you know, psychological, he's shown himself to be a danger not only to black communities, but society in general. So, you know, government has a moral obligation and duty to protect us from such individuals.
Carmen, what about the question of how much you should try to figure out why this kid did what he did? Is that an important question?
I think it is indeed an important question. And I don't think this sentence was just, but it's self-preservationist. I don't think any justice is possible in a case like this, given the lack of successful mental health care options in prison or offered to poor people in general, in large for that matter. Sure, this young man shows every tendency of being a sexual predator, and there's no place to put him except in prison, and that's a shame. But I would rather have him behind bars than walking out on the street.
I want to move on to a related topic, crime and punishment. Yesterday on the show, we talked about a new report from Pepperdine University that says that for every person executed, the next year, 74 fewer people are murdered. Now, some have concluded that capital punishment is therefore an effective deterrent to crime. Shay, do you think that someone is less likely to commit a crime if they think they might get the death penalty? Do you buy into these numbers, which were highly in debate?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think it was great that the researchers who were behind this included people who were both for and against the death penalty, so it provides some balance. To me, of course, the death penalty deters crime because, you know, people who get put to death are guaranteed not to commit any more crimes. They're dead. So, you know, I think that's a very important point, considering the recidivism rates of criminals and, you know, and it's despite all of the prevalence of rehabilitation programs that are clearly not working. And I should also point out that the death penalty is not only supposed to be a deterrent to crime, but for me, at least, more importantly, about justice.
Mark, we've had some different competing angles come into both our blog News and Views and then also to our letters. One person said there should be a lot more executions. Another person said deterrence should not be the issue. The issue is, and I'm paraphrasing here, more along a human rights line and whether or not there are people who are being executed who should not have even been convicted in the first place. How do you see those different angles playing into this overall debate about the death penalty?
You know, it's one of those situations where, you know, folks take very, very hard lines around the death penalty. And in that regard, I'm a hard line in terms of being against it. But at the same time, I think it is useful that we do have increased data for us to think about how this framework takes place. I think the human rights issue is a credible one. I know that we have cases where folks have been put to death unfairly. The idea that there should be some sort of restraint from the state in regards to how we go forward in terms of these kinds of cases are very important. I thought one of the things was very critical in terms of the response to this, when you read the piece that's, you know, at the Huffington Report, this idea that most folks really are unaware of when, you know, folks are put to death, unless it is a very, very public case, you know, which is either public because you're dealing with an individual who just far out, you know, in terms of the crimes they committed, or if it's a case where there's questions about whether or not the person is innocent or not, or whether or not they actually did the crime. And I think when you think about it as being a public forum where some of these cases play out, then the idea that it functions as a deterrent, I think, actually works much more. You can argue that much more forcefully than, you know, in the case that just the numbers of people who are put to death actually serve as a deterrent.
Carmen, what about that whole idea that people don't even know a lot of the time when there are executions, maybe in some high-profile cases, but not in every single one?
That, to me, really undercut the legitimacy of the study. And also, there were didn't look at other correlating factors, possibly economic changes, anything else that might lead to this decrease observed in homicides.
Now, I want to turn to a topic that actually involves all of you, the blogosphere. So last week, the Reverend Al Sharpton and Martin Luther King III led a march of tens of thousands of people to the Capitol. They want the feds to toughen hate crime laws. The FBI said that hate crimes are on the rise, but blogger Shane Johnson had a different kind of protest in mind. He organized a counter-protest to Al Sharpton's rally, saying many African Americans are unhappy with the way that black leadership like Sharpton's are silent about black-on-black crime. Now, we spoke to Shane. He says five people showed up to support his efforts last Friday. That's right, five people. But the Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page wrote up a story about it. Carmen, if only five people show up to the counter protest, but half a dozen blogs pick up the story and then another few pick up the story, does that mean that the protest was a success?
I think absolutely. I think his point of view and this story is only growing, at least in my mind. Everything from the aspect of That the fact that Shane got heat from other established black bloggers for taking on an established member of the civil rights movement. And a lot of us are pushing back and saying, wait a minute, we're long past the time when we have to care about what white people think as we go and heal wounds in our black community. So I think this is only going to be a bigger discussion, and Shane has just kicked off something that's only going to snowball.
Mark?
I'm with Carmen on this. I mean, I think there's been for a long time, obviously within the black blogosphere, but yeah, obviously in black communities, where people have been trying to push back about this notion that our civil rights leaders are untouchable, that we cannot openly hold them, you know, accountable for the acts that they do, and that this accountability doesn't simply play out in terms of ideology, right? That it's not just, say, a conservative black blogosphere versus a liberal black blogosphere, but many folks who consider themselves being well on the left are also trying to hold black leadership accountable. And I think very often those kind of lines get mixed and missed, you know, in the larger conversation about black folks trying to hold leadership accountable.
Shay, what about the whole idea of voting with your feet versus voting with your blog? I mean, they seem to be two parallel tracks right now in American discourse, where some people are saying, I'm going to show up, I'm going to put on my jacket, I'm going to stand and march and listen to speeches. Other people are saying, I'm going to go and do online activism or online commentary. Are these two forms of communication going to compete with each other? Is one going to trump the other?
Well, I see them as, you know, reinforcing each other. I don't see it as an either-or situation. I think we can talk and chew, you know, at the same time. And, you know, I'm completely with Shane on this one, you know, and as well as liberal columnist Clarence Page, in terms of we need to focus. Yes, hate crimes are, you know, vile and vicious, but we should also focus on the higher number of black-on-black violence within our community, which I would consider has gotten to the point where I would call those self-hate crimes. You know, why aren't those a category? Yeah. So I'm glad he's holding, you know, the leadership to the fire. And it's good to see people across ideology doing that.
Well, Shay, Mark, and Carmen, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, happy holidays. I'm going to say that about 12 times, but that's all right. So we've been speaking with Shay Riley of the blog Booker Rising. She was at member station WBEZ in Chicago. Media consultant Carmen Dixon Rosenzweig writes the blog All About Race. She was with me at NPR West. And Mark Anthony Neal writes Vibe Magazine's blog Critical Noir. He's also a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He was at our New York studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues that you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind.